This is the Mile High Five podcast with Carl Jensen and Doug Cunnington. We have authentic conversations about the journey to Phi, health, happiness, and some very odd tangents. We interview Phi experts, side hustlers, people on their way to Phi, and those who have reached the other side. Join us every week, and if you want the show notes and links and all that other stuff, head over to milehighfi.com. Hey, what's going on? Welcome to the Mile High Five podcast. I am Doug Cunnington and Carl is out today. So I have Amberly Grant sitting in with me. And today we're going to talk about reasons why millionaires think they're middle class. So you, listener, viewer out there, what do you think of when you think of middle class? What do you think of when you think of millionaire? And I want you to think about what normal people think about millionaires in the middle class. And if you're listening to this, I actually know you're a weirdo. So think of the normal people, not just you. And if normal people, non-Phi people, think about being a millionaire, they think about a rich person or the super wealthy and that sort of thing. And this episode was inspired by a video I watched over on YouTube called The Reality of the Middle Class. And shout out to the YouTuber Erin Talks Money. We'll link up to her channel and the video so you can go check it out. I watch a lot of YouTube videos, so sometimes I get some ideas from there. She cited stories about how millionaires think they are middle class. And I checked out some of the kind of shittier articles out there. One of them was over on Yahoo Finance, but there were a series of them. And I quickly went to the original survey and the actual data out there. So in this episode, we're going to talk about the definition of middle class. And again, form that idea in your mind so you think about what you define middle class as. And when we get to the actual definition, you'll be able to compare. We'll also talk about the study, including the sample size, some of the findings, and a little bit more. We'll talk about feeling wealthy or rich, which Carl and I covered in episode 203. And we'll also talk about the definition of upper class, which is interesting. So Amberly, you are best known for FinTalks, and we could talk a little bit more about that later, but let us know who you are for people that haven't heard of you or never met you before.
Yep. I'm Amberly Grant. I, you know, run communities online and in person now for, you know, money nerds that like to actually hang out and have fun. So I do things like cruises, in-person events, and a Tuesday FinTalks, which we can talk about another time. I love real estate, long walks on the beach, poems, guitar solos, and Jack Johnson.
Wow. All right. And Jack Johnson doesn't have a ton of guitar solos, so you have to go elsewhere for that.
Yeah. Okay. I guess, you know, he's just like one guitar solo the entire time, yeah. Right? Yeah, yeah, just serenading my sweetheart out.
And we'll talk more about FinTalks a little bit later in the episode. So let's just jump right into it here. So regular listeners of the show will know the definition of a millionaire, and it's based on net worth. So we're talking assets minus liability. So pretty simple, and there's nothing else to add about that. In the video, Erin points out net worth profile. So we can do the same and maybe extend it a little bit here. So Amberly, can you go through the three scenarios? Yep. And we could chat a little bit about it, but just so people have an idea, like what Erin pointed out in her video. And it's a good way to set the stage just to distinguish some different profiles out there.
Yep. And what I would challenge a person, because sometimes when you throw out numbers and scenarios, keep one in your head that you find interesting. So if we relay back to it, or you might follow that one specific household, one, two, or three throughout the entire podcast episode so that, you know, you've kind of got an anchor while you're doing it. Net worth profiles. So something to think about. Household one owns a $500,000 home and has investments worth $500,000. 50-50 split for $1 million. Household two has full investments of $1 million, but does not have any equity in a home. So only investments. Household three owns a $1 million home, but has no outside investments. And when we're talking about that $1 million home, we're talking primary residence. So no income producing property. Is that correct, Doug?
Yes. And some people might be thinking, well, that's kind of an outlandish thing. Like, why does someone have no investments, but they have a $1 million home? But think about a retired couple, like working class. Maybe they bought a home in the 80s, right? So property values in California and across the country exploded, but really in California, especially. So you can imagine like whatever, a school teacher and a janitor buying a place in the 80s. They got a 30-year mortgage. They've paid it off. And they might have a home that's worth like $1.2 million. And they have virtually no other assets. Maybe they have a pension or something that is not tied to investments directly. So pretty easy to imagine. Can you think of any other things we should highlight here, Amberly?
No, but I think that $1 million home is actually much more common than people think. It's a forced savings account that a lot of people used in the 80s and 90s. And I know, coming from Canada, that is a huge, huge portion of people's net worth up there.
And when you think of areas that have just exploded with growth and population growth, economic growth overall, like there are a lot of little pockets all over all over the world where it's, you know, huge amount of equity in there. So big contrast compared to the people that have investments, and maybe you have investments in index funds and you have income generating assets. Now, we only highlighted three just to make our point. They're all extremely simple and there's not much of a spectrum. It's like all investments or all home equity or 50-50. Yeah. But obviously, there could be a wide spectrum of how this is made up. Kind of infinite examples, but here are three easy ones to help make the point. So, a couple things that I want to get into here, and we'll read out the specific part of the survey which highlights the millionaires that think they're middle class. So,
before we do anything, I want listeners, especially because you at the very beginning said, like, okay, there are quote unquote normal people, and then there's the listeners. And I actually challenge the listener to say, before we get into any definitions or we talk about this, what are you? Are you middle class? And I'm not going to say lower class because more than likely a lot of people here have, it's kind of self-selected out for that. But are you middle class? Are you upper middle class? Or are you upper class? And keep that in your head. And then let's get honest with ourselves.
Right. Yeah. And we did this off the record just a minute ago, which, yeah, it was truly off the record, not even recorded for soundcheck. Okay. So we have some of the findings, and I'll just mention really quick, like there was a study out there by Ameriprise Financial, and it was conducted online by the Artemis Strategy Group in early 2023. And one interesting way that this information gets spread across the world is some writers, some blog will study all these surveys that are out there, and they'll check out the press release, and then they will try to come up with controversial headlines that will get picked up. So this smaller website, Insider Monkey, which is probably fairly big, but they wrote an article and it was syndicated on Yahoo Finance, and a bunch of other outlets also wrote their own original articles. So if you go, if you search for like millionaires think they're middle class, like the study wasn't on that. The survey was actually for 3,518 Americans from ages 27 to 77. There were 580 of those in the sample size that were millionaires. Again, 27 to 77. And there was there were a lot of findings throughout, but this is the point that got picked up all over the place. Most millionaires don't consider themselves wealthy. 6 in 10 investors with a million or more in that full sample size, right? They consider themselves upper middle class. So 60% said they were upper middle class. An additional 31%. So this is the part. 31% of the millionaires said that they were middle class. 8% said they were wealthy. Hopefully that adds up to pretty darn close to 100%, but those were the findings. And I think, you know, again, there's many other details in here, but that's the key part. So what's your first impression, Amberly, when you hear that 31% consider themselves middle class?
I think it makes a lot of sense. Whenever you're doing a case study or you're hearing people being interviewed on podcasts, I think most people, unless you've worked on it, have somewhat of a scarcity mindset. And that scarcity mindset translates into, I don't have enough, therefore I am not XYZ. I am not wealthy. I'm not upper class. But the numbers don't lie, right? And if we're looking at those three scenarios, you have a house only, you have half investments, half a house, or you have full investments, your purchasing power and what you can do in an everyday life is very different based on those scenarios. So it makes sense that people don't really know where they fit in, and probably emotion drives a lot of that feeling. Also, remember, we're like an American culture where like you have to bootstrap and you probably don't want to be too like boastful. So to say like, yes, I'm upper class might also be a bit of a taboo. So those are the things I think about it. What about you?
I found it pretty interesting because I could see both sides of it, right? And I understand how people who are middle class, even we're going to go through definitions of middle class based on income. We're going to talk about the actual net worth and maybe some other factors that play into it. But essentially, I can see how that can happen. And, you know, you have books like Millionaire Next Door, right, that highlight some of the characteristics. And you're like, oh, like I can see how this plays out. And just to be very specific, like in our community, again, we're all weirdos. If you're listening, if you're watching this, we're weirdos. Unless it somehow goes viral on YouTube and other people watch it, then we'll get a lot of hate comments.
Of course.
Which would be great. Yes. We'd love to hear that.
Interaction is interaction.
So we know in our FIRE community that if you don't live that flashy, then potentially, not always, but potentially, you're pretty wealthy because you're not outwardly using that money. However, you know, if you look around our neighborhoods or whatever, and you see like nice new cars, you see a lot of nice new cars, you see like fancy clothes and stuff like that, you know, I mean, they're spending a lot of money. Their expenses are really high. And us now, like we see a flashy new car, we're thinking, oh man, that person doesn't have their priorities straight. We're judging them. We're judging them. Although if you like cars, you know, do the car thing.
Yeah. You get one thing.
Yeah. You just get one. So I can see where people on both sides are like, I disagree with that. And I can see why from a media standpoint, people are highlighting this point, even though it was only 31%. It's not like the majority of millionaires think it was 31%, which is a sizable amount.
Yeah.
But, you know, a handful of them are thinking, hey, we're upper middle class. Mm-hmm. Now, the next thing we have to get into, right? So if you do a survey of 3,000 random people, or not random, 3,000 people that are willing to do a survey.
Yes.
Right. So that's different than just regular people, right?
Yes.
You're busy. You'd be like, fuck that. I'm not doing a survey, right? So what is middle class, right? So I don't know. It's unclear. I didn't look through. And the thing is, like, if you just ask a question and you don't define what it is, then who knows how it's self-reporting, right? So let's define middle class. And this is from Investopedia, which is kind of a go-to source. So do you want to read out the definition here?
The middle class is a description given to individuals and households who typically fall between the working class and the upper class within a social economic hierarchy. Literally tells me nothing. I don't understand.
Right.
Because again, that's what is your perception?
Yeah.
Like what? I work. Am I working class? I'm not working class, guys.
Yeah. What's funny, I asked Elizabeth, my wife, and I was like, how do you define middle class? Yeah. And she was like, between, they say, we call it working class, not lower class. Yeah. That's a new thing that I just wrote. So working class is between working class and upper class. Again, it doesn't really tell us anything. They do say the key takeaways over on Investopedia. The middle class is a socio and economic strata that falls in between working and upper. The middle class is about half of the U.S. population, but it shrunk over the last 50 years. Yeah. those in the middle class have enough disposable income to afford minor luxuries like vacations or restaurants, but also rely on borrowing for big ticket items like homes and cars. Yep. So we're getting a little bit closer.
I like that one. And Doug, what would you have defined middle class as? Would you have put numbers in there?
So most of the time, the answer is yes. I would have defined it most likely based on income, okay, because most of the time that is what I heard referenced. Not
that just in general.
Yeah.
Zeitgeist.
I have no, the horse in the race here, but, generally I would have thought of income and sort of the income side, basically.
Yeah. Cause I would have thought income, if you had to say, Amberly, define the middle class, according to me, I would say someone with some disposable income. So whatever that means would be like, oh, they can buy that car that they want. They're not buying like the $80,000 Tesla, but maybe they buy the $45,000 Tesla. Their income's probably around $65,000 to like $75,000 a year, depending on, you know, where they live. And that's the two defining factors for me that I would have gone through.
Yeah, it's very interesting because then...
Then if you would ask me if I was in that survey, then I would categorize myself based on my own interpretation of what middle class is, which would be the same for you, right? You're like, I would think income, not net worth.
Right. And yeah, and we'll get into the net worth portion in a second. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it really makes things a little confusing.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure they didn't define it when they were asking the question. The other part, let's say they did define it and say, hey, base it on net worth. Mm-hmm. Everyone that was surveyed, apparently they had to figure up their net worth, or they knew it ahead of time, mm-hmm, or they guessed.
Yes.
And I don't know. I didn't read all the fine print of mm-hmm the full survey. So I don't know how they calculated their net worth.
Yeah. Right.
I think they probably did a little more digging, but it would be interesting if it was self-reported.
Oh, yeah. For like the actual who are millionaires. Oh, that's okay. Yeah. Well, anywho, we'll just pretend that they actually knew who was millionaires and who is not, because yeah, this is some good journalism here.
Okay. So from an income perspective, I did mm-hmm a little bit more digging. This is the most preparation I've done for an episode ever. Yeah. So the Pew Research Center defines middle class as an income that ranges between two-thirds and double the median income. The exact boundaries of a middle class income vary by family size and location due to geographic differences in cost of living, which is something we didn't even bring up before. And that works out to an annual income between $52,000 and $156,000 for a three-person household as of 2020. And one thing I looked up was, what is a household? What does that mean exactly? So per the U.S. Census, a household includes all the people who occupy a housing unit. So like a house or an apartment unit, not like apartment.
Yeah. Just the actual like unit number.
Right. So if we had like, if you guys lived in our basement,
yes,
then our household would be all four of us.
Yes.
And
I know that from the census showing up at my door when I had roommates.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's a little bit misleading.
Correct.
Probably a rare occasion, but it happens and it could, you know, skew the data.
Yeah.
The outliers can really screw up the data.
Yeah. So. And probably not enough for it to make a difference. Plus it's using median, right? Mm-hmm. Is median the one where it shows up the most?
Median is denoting to a value or quantity lying at the midpoint of a frequency distribution of observed values or quantities.
The exact middle.
Okay.
Not the average.
Yep. So they're using
the middle. Exact middle.
All right. So to summarize, middle class based on the survey, Pew Research Center, 52,000 to 156 for a household. Upper class, and this is another survey by the Pew Research Center of 2018, and 19% of adults in the U.S. were part of upper class households. So 19%. The families earned a median of $187 in 2016, compared to 52% who made up the middle class and 29% who made up the working class. Mm-hmm. So, all that said, I looked over at the Census Bureau just to get sort of the ranges for income, and the working class is less than 30,000. Working class to middle class is 30 to 58,000. Middle class is 58 to 94, and upper middle class is 94 to 153. And upper class is greater than 153,000. And again, this is a 2022 report by the Census Bureau. Any thoughts on all those definitions and ranges and details?
I think the most compelling part really is when you compare all the classes together and then you think about them in your own terms based on your parents or who you are and things like that. When I'm like, oh, working class, less than $30,000, that's how I grew up. Like less than 30 grand, less than 20 grand a year. But then I've moved through these to get into like upper class. And looking at this, I wouldn't have placed myself in upper class a year ago, right? Like I would be like, no way. In my head, I'm like working class, but upper, like, but I'm not. Mm-hmm. And so I find this really fascinating when you actually look at the proper definition of where you stand, really challenges yourself. And I think helps to really create the definition of where people are. Like this is pretty interesting.
And if people want to go a little deeper, I prepared for this episode. So we will actually put the links and references to all the stuff that I'm mentioning, whether it's the Pew Research or the Census Bureau. You can check out the PDFs, and it's a good bedtime reading overall.
And the one thing I like about this is when we talked about the definition above, we talked about a very big range. I think it was 52,000 to 156,000 for a household. And that's a huge range. That has a lot of different purchasing power. Someone making $52,000 a year in Denver can barely afford rent. Someone making $152,000 can easily afford rent and maybe some other things, but whatever life of luxury, I don't know what they're living, right? And so when you actually say, no, no, it's lower middle class, is like 52,000 is actually lower middle class until the 58,000 mark. Then you've got actual middle class, and then you've got upper middle class in that like 94 to 153. I don't know if it actually matters which slot you're in, but I think it really does help to understand more than just one category.
And the part that is missing in the quick copy and paste that I threw into our notes here is I don't know if there's any geographic considerations on this. Obviously, the cost of living in San Francisco, New York City, LA, other big cities, it's going to be so much more than a farm town in Iowa. Mm-hmm. It's going to be dramatically different, or even a big town in Iowa, right? Correct. It's still going to be like way more expensive. No offense to Iowa. Just drove through.
Yeah.
A lot of corn.
Yeah.
Fuck load of corn.
Yes.
But a fine state.
Yes.
Much cheaper than so many other better places to live. No offense. We don't have a lot of people in Iowa.
Not anymore.
Shoot me an email. Yeah. Shoot me an email if you're in Iowa.
Yeah.
Sorry about that. Iowa.
Okay. It's okay. They're all in Denver. So that's
they moved the fuck out.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like Michigan. I know a lot of people from Michigan. Uh-huh. None of them live there.
No. I know a lot of people from Iowa. yes.
Uh-huh. Great. Okay. So we talked about income, and it sounds like both of us and probably a lot of people, their first impression when they hear middle class or upper class or whatever classification, we're thinking income first, generally. However, very clearly in our FIRE community, a lot of us are going to have very low income once we quit working. Mm-hmm. And we don't necessarily think of the compound interest adding up as income, I know I wouldn't. I'd just be like, oh, I have really low income right now.
Yeah. You wouldn't look at your investments and say, oh, okay, because I made, I don't know, $100,000 on my investments, I only pulled out maybe $45,000 of that. That would be your income, essentially. But the actual truth is you have another $55,000 of not actual income definition, but of money generating money that, you know, that exists.
And your net worth, like if you were just looking at your net worth, like obviously once you get to a certain point, let's look at like the Jensens, Carl and Mindy, mm-hmm. since Carl does publish his net numbers, worth out there. So he could have $1 million a year where his net worth went up by that much.
Correct.
Of course, the dividends won't be that high, but like if you just look at the pure numbers, like it's gone up quite a bit. And I think once you hit a, you know, a certain point, the compound interest and the growth can be unbelievable.
Correct.
Which is why compound interest is so great.
Yes.
So let's talk about the net worth aspect, and you can go ahead and read these out again based on the US Census from 2021. So what do we have for the classes?
So we have working class is $12,000 of net worth. Working to middle class is approximately $61,000 of net worth. If you're talking pure middle class, it's $145,000 of net worth. Upper middle class is $269,000 in net worth. And then you've got upper class, which is $805,000 of net worth. Whoa.
And I mean, it's very... it's eye-opening, right? And again, in the FIRE community, we're coming at this a little bit different. And I would have thought the upper class was like way higher. Yeah. Like I thought
what
it was
going to be.
What would you think?
Sorry? What would you think?
Knowing there are some extremely wealthy people, I guess I would have thought maybe like 3 or 5 million, something like that. Like, okay. Fairly significant. Yeah. What about you?
1.5 million is the first thought I had.
Okay. And like my gut at first was like 1 million, but obviously 800K is like, it's getting pretty close to it.
Yeah.
But one of the things in a few of the articles, and I think maybe Erin even pointed this out in her video, but $1 million used to be like the sort of reference point.
Yeah.
And inflation and the years have gone on. So it's like $1 million is great.
Yes.
Amazing.
Yeah.
But if you compare it to $1990 or something like that, I mean, you're talking about something completely different.
Correct.
So, and it's like when I was going to college, people were like, you know, if you can get a job where you're making 50K a year, that's amazing.
Right.
No, it's 100K.
Yes.
Right. So like literally it's doubled and it's 20 years later.
Yep.
So.
Well, the first book I ever read was The Wealthy Barber. And the whole point, I guess, like everything leading up to that book is becoming a millionaire, like having $1 million in investable assets as you turn 65. I think it's 65. Sorry if I'm getting these wrong. But that was what I took away from it at 15 years old, was like, okay, if I invest $25 a week for the rest of my life, I'll have $1 million. It's $1 million. That's insane. And that was, you know, 95. I don't know how old I was then, but like sometime in early 2000.
You read it when you were like 5.
Yeah, I was like, no, I was 15. So I don't know, sometime in the early 2000s. So that was like the gold standard, have $1 million at retirement.
Yeah, so I thought it would be a little bit higher. But then, I mean, I've been running across other pieces of data where it's like people that are retiring, or if you search for like, how much do I need to retire?
Yeah.
You'll find people have like a net worth when they're whatever 62 and they're retiring, they have like 120,000.
Yes.
Which is, it seems, again, we're in the FIRE community, yeah. So it seems really low. Like low.
Yes.
Yeah.
But
we're coming at it differently.
Yeah. And again, net worth now we're talking about homes, right? Before we were talking about income, and income is what's coming in from like, you know, I guess investments and or your actual labor or business or whatever it might be. But now when you're talking about net worth, you're talking about general assets, like your car is part of that net worth, but it's not actually going to, although like your car is useful to make money, it's not actually making you money. And so I think net worth, when you're comparing net worth versus income, you're looking at very different individuals. And it kind of makes sense that these numbers are like, I don't want to use the word quite vague, but like middle class at 145,000 versus upper class at 800,000, that's a huge jump. But when you look at the income jump, it's not that crazy. Middle class highest income is 94,000 and upper class is 153,000. Like if you're already making 100 grand a year, to get to 150,000 actually isn't a huge jump. You know, like if you can cross that barrier already. So I'm just like looking at these ones, but like your middle class from 145,000 to upper class is $800,000 net worth. Like that's a huge jump. That's a lot of time. That's a lot of appreciation in a house, which can take time. That's a lot. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. One, the other thing I think about, you know, you're putting the two together.
Yeah.
And this could happen like anywhere that you travel, mm-hmm. or anywhere you live, but we'll head out to the mountains and we'll drive on I-70. And there are these huge mansions like on bluffs and, mm-hmm. and I'm 90% sure like most of those are second homes.
Right? They're empty.
They are ridiculous. And again, you can see this everywhere. So we went to Indiana Dunes National Park and there were some huge, amazing houses overlooking Lake Michigan there. Yeah. And again, you can see this anywhere that you go. There's always like pretty wealthy people. Mm-hmm. I imagine the net worth should have been much higher. So even when you consider there's not that many people, mm-hmm. like the ultra wealthy, the whatever, $100 million plus, like those folks would skew it a little bit more.
Right.
But here we're looking at it, it's just 800K.
Yeah, but then you also have to think the on the lower end, the working class also skew it. Because there are a ton of people, if we're talking about households here, you have a ton of teenagers making minimum wage. So then you also have a bunch of people who are 16 to 24, let's say, because maybe the college graduates are starting to make the $50,000. But you have, say, those people who are younger, who are skewing the data as well towards the left in that way, like the lower, like the left end of the spectrum, which is, mm-hmm. well, like the working class. So you've got those two extremes on both sides. And then you, again, with the middle class shrinking, now the data is much more, you know, skewed in the sense of you've got
extremes.
You have extreme working class with lots of people in there. And even an extreme upper class, because, you know, that tide rose with a lot of people. So, which, like, not that anyone cares, but it's interesting because in Canada, when the U.S.'s middle class has been declining for like 50 years, Canada was continually having one of the strongest middle classes in the world. And I learned this from a documentary about middle class shrinking in the U.S. by that guy who's like the economic person and like he's in like every White House, shorter man, has a great documentary on this. But now in Canada, we're actually having that issue where our middle class is shrinking. And one of the reasons is because the only net worth people have is houses. That's all they have. And so if you have nothing else, like, cool, you can have, you know, a $700,000 house, but you don't have a lot else. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, so it's a shrinking class in Canada as well now.
So we have a sponsor today. A listener contacted us about being one of his favorite shows and potentially sponsoring the show. And that's Rich. So if you were out there in Cincinnati at Economy, Rich hung out and partied. And yeah, he's a great guy. And we like Ghost Bed. So we actually have a new product coming our way, which we'll test out. I won't mention it here because I'm not sure when this is coming out and I don't know when the product is released, but we'll have some information on that. Now, Amberly, how do you sleep? Are you a good sleeper?
I normally am a fantastic sleeper. At this moment in my life, I am not a good sleeper.
Okay. Mm-hmm. What are you struggling with?
Thanks, Doug. I am struggling with waking up in the middle of the night, getting comfortable, literally the size of my pillow, the location of it. I actually used to never sleep with a pillow, but it turns out as my body is changing, I need a pillow. And so I'm struggling with the front pillow. I need a pillow in my back so I don't fall onto my back. And then everything's just messed. Okay. So I'm having a hard time.
You are. I'm sorry to hear that. So Ghost Bed actually has pretty nice foam pillows, and they have like sort of a cooling gel. Are you a warm sleeper in general?
I'm not though.
You're a cool.
I am a okay. cool sleeper.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm the blanket hog.
Okay, and then even now you're pregnant right now. Yes. Does that make you warmer?
I think. Well, after pregnancy, when your hormones like go crazy, yeah, you like wake up in night sweats. Mm. It'll be fun.
Okay.
Yeah. So it sounds like I need a ghost pillow here. Yeah.
You check that out. Yeah. And it does, the gel keeps you cooler, but one of the mattresses that they have, I'm 90% sure people could double check, but I know they have some heating capability. Oh. So if you are a cold sleeper, you can bump it up. Like I said, double check that. People can go check out the website. I do know the mystery product that I didn't mention that I will talk about later in the future. It does have, I'm certain it does have like a massaging capability.
Oh, no
way. And then some heat stuff happening as well. So you can warm you up, or rub your back a little bit, your calves or whatever.
Yeah.
Make you feel nice.
If they haven't marketed this to pregnant women, like, or soon to be pregnant women, hell yeah. Because like we all get sciatic pain. I have restless leg syndromes every night. So my legs feel like I have lightning going through them, which used to be normal for me anyhow, but now it's like every night. Oh, I literally wake up and I'm like aching. And then when you have your baby, we're like co-sleepers. So whatever you want to say about that, I don't care. I sleep with my kid for the first like 2 months and I'm in like these weird positions to make sure it's safe. And I don't put blankets on because you can't have blankets or pillows to be like safe co-sleeping. So having like a bed that just would be like comfortable would be very like clutch.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll see. We may be able to help you out on that. So what so no blankets. So you just like dress warm or whatever.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Yeah. You can have like a sheet, but it has to be at your waist or down. And last time it was summertime. So I just, you know,
it's
hung out. Enough. Yeah. Yeah. But like, I'm a cold sleeper, so I actually do need some sort of sheet, and it's very comforting. So, but the whole point is you don't want your kid who can't move to get wrapped up into anything, right?
Yeah, no weighted blankets.
100% no weighted blankets in that first little bit.
So Ghost Bed is awesome, so do check it out. We have a couple of the products, and Carl and I have tested them out. They have over 60,000 five-star reviews and patented sleep and cooling technology. Their mattresses are crafted for unbeatable comfort, and they're made in the USA. They have a 101-night at-home sleep trial and a 20-year warranty. So you can go to ghostbed.com/milehighfi and use code milehighfi at checkout and you'll get 50% off. So thanks a lot to Ghostbed.
50%. Whoa.
It's crazy. Ghostbed.com/milehighfi. Okay. So we had a lot of preamble there so we could finally get to the fucking point here. Excellent. Why do millionaires feel like they are middle class? Again, 31% of the millionaires in that survey, they felt like they were middle class. So why is that? And we have a couple notes here, but before we even get into that, why do you think, Amber, like, do you have any thoughts like right off the bat without looking at some of the other notes here?
For me, like when I think about why do millionaires think they're middle class, I actually think about the FI community. I think about people who have a lot of money, they have scarcity mindset. And so to think you're wealthy or upper class, which I think we're just kind of using that word interchangeably in this one. So upper class meaning, you know, you make either over $153,000 or your net worth is $805,000, including your home and cars, right? Like you are now upper class in comparison to others. And I think that's one of the key things. It's in comparison to others. So your spending might not spend like someone you think is upper class. Or you don't have the things that you think upper class looks like because of television shows, movies, et cetera, because you don't actually know what upper class is. So that's one of my first things of why it kind of makes sense why 31% of those millionaires would think they're middle class, even though by definition they are not, because they're net worth, right? If we're talking net worth alone. I also think there's kind of a social stigma of saying, like of boasting. So stay humble, right? Like bootstraps, pick yourself up by your bootstraps. I'm pretty sure like Protestant culture in the United States is very much about like working hard, you know, work hard in this lifetime. You'll be rewarded later if you've got some sort of spiritual leaning. And so to say I am upper class almost as like a social faux pas. So I think automatically, just like when I ask people on the podcast, like, you know, who are listening right now, how would you, like, do you consider yourself middle class, upper middle class, or upper class? I bet a lot of people who are actually upper class consider themselves middle class or upper middle class. And so that's my first thoughts on that is it makes sense, but you're wrong.
Yeah. And well, to your point, I think when I was preparing for this and chatting with you and Elizabeth and just thinking about it, I identify as middle class.
Yeah.
But by any of the definitions that we've talked about, I am not.
Correct.
And haven't been for a long time.
Right.
And it makes no sense. But there's a couple things. Like, I grew up middle class.
Yes.
And that's sort of like in my head. And then when I got a job, I did fine, but I was always earning less than fucking everyone that I knew, or at least I felt that way.
Yeah.
But I'm 90% sure everyone did make more money than me,
yeah.
at least in my little circle. So I always felt behind.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, when it comes down to it, almost all this stuff we're talking about, like, doesn't matter on a grander level.
No.
And it's all just, like you said, it's in relation to what other people have.
Correct.
Not what I'm trying to do.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I still feel scrappy, you know.
Yeah.
I was trying to get the business going and all this stuff. But at the same time, now I'm like, I have a ton of free time. Yeah. It's great.
Yeah.
Which I think that would be an interesting way to define wealth is like, how much free time do you have? Because like, if you have a lot of free time, that trumps a lot of money in the bank because a lot of people just fucking... I mean, especially in our community, we don't spend the money. Like, a lot of us just keep hoarding it.
Yeah, right, exactly.
All right, so you mentioned a little bit about the social faux pas of just being like, hey, I'm super rich and like having the money and then flaunting it. And that's a bad look most of the time. And I've been listening and reading a lot of Morgan Housel recently, and one of the things he's mentioned, I'm sure he's referenced other people, but when people are, you know, looking up to you or you feel like you're being admired because you're like, I am wealthy and people look up to me, they don't really look up to you. They're envious of what you have. So I think you and I are a little bit different than the audience in that we have like our platforms where we are producing content.
Yeah.
So there are certain things that we have to do and we put a certain framing in our a little bit of context, but we have to say like, we're doing these things which are interesting and you should pay attention to us.
Right.
So it's a little like we have to toe the line of like what we want to share, not be jerks about it.
Yeah, don't be too boastful.
But also point out that you can start a business, or if you save and you live below your means, you could become a millionaire in X number of years and have like some flashy headlines. So we're in a weird spot where we do need to share some information and highlight things, but not be dicks about it.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people equate the two things, right? Money is evil. People with money are dicks. You even kind of alluded to it actually as you were talking, which gives me some insight into your own psyche, right? Which was people who are wealthy are flashy. And I know you're kind of giving an example, but the way that you were framing who is wealthy also tells me what you think about wealth. And so that's like really interesting is if you think of a wealthy person, what do you see? Like, do you see an asshole? Like, do you see someone driving this flashy car? Because the wealthy people I know are actually extremely generous. They're generous with their time, their knowledge. They might have free time. They might not, because they are still like their purpose in life is just to continue creating. And so I think that's really fascinating. And to your point of towing a line, one of the things that I have really, I've been working on actually over the past like a year now, it's been 1 year, March of last year, I wanted to really understand and get real with where I was with my finances, because I'm like, we already had a fire fail episode, right? Where we like talked about how we're both failures of fire. And one of the things is I had never actually calculated my net worth and didn't actually look into it. And what does that all mean? And I just kept going on and, you know, doing my thing. And what I realized a year ago when I was doing all those numbers and I was looking up like women ages this to this, making this amount, like where do I fall in all this? And I'm like 3% in just like women who make money, right? With like my job. And that gave me a really good perspective of like, holy shit, I'm in the top 3 percentile, or maybe it was 5 percentile of US women making money, like just from my day job. Or maybe it was my rentals as well. I can't remember what those numbers are. And of course, if you compare it to the men's side, like I'm like 15th percentile or something like that, right? But having that like really did give me some more perspective. So this is, none of this is actually too surprising for me, because I've been really trying to grapple with that transparency to my community, right? Because cool, I'm not going to tell you guys where my houses are or like how much I make every single month or what my expenses are specifically, because I just don't think that's necessary. And I don't really want to put that money, that information out there. You can probably find it and back into it, whatever you want to do. I don't care. I do want to be transparent about the fact that I started at lower class. Literally 5.5 years ago, I was making an average of $15,000 a year. My net worth was lower class, 12 grand. Yeah, that makes about sense. And that was 6 years ago. And now I'm upper class. And there's ways that I've gotten to do that. Hard work, luck, finishing school, whatever all those things are. But what I really like about it is that you can get there. And why do millionaires feel like they're middle class? Well, they might have started there. Their family starts there. Like there's a million. I get it.
The other thing which we pointed out is people will use their own definitions. Mm-hmm. So if they're just thinking, I didn't look in the survey exactly what they asked, and they said, you know, here's a definition of middle class. I don't think that was done, mm-hmm. but we're using our own definitions. And even if they said, use this definition, there's a chance that the survey participant still stuck with whatever it is they think. Correct. And however they define middle class. And they're like, well, I worked hard and I am middle class. And
I hustled to get to where I am. So therefore I am middle class. And that was my first question to you, was going to be, when you found out you are actually upper class, when you were kind of considering yourself middle class, did you like fight against that? Like, did a part of you be like, nah?
No, I mean, I already knew.
Yeah, you're like, yeah, okay, fine. I'm gonna admit it to myself now.
Yeah, I already knew, but I think the other thing, not only the definition, but like me, like I already knew the answer, mm-hmm. and then I was, when I saw the numbers, I was like, oh, I am not surprised. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I was like, I feel like I'm middle class because of like my spending habits and my normal general outlook, I think, mm-hmm. and it's a mindset.
Yes.
It's not a number.
Right. Yes, that's exactly it. Yeah.
So that's weird, right? So it's a mindset. And yeah. Like we were talking earlier, like you work super hard.
Yeah.
You work so hard. I don't know why. you're so busy.
Yeah.
But you like have the work drive of, yeah, the working class, middle class. And I guess it goes across the spectrum. Like, correct. It doesn't matter. Like, yeah. People work hard in any of the socioeconomic, however we're defining it.
Correct.
So.
Yeah. Yeah. And my thing, like totally off topic, but that's actually something to think about, right? Why do you work so hard if you have money? And that, you know, that's a whole other fun topic. But when I saw the numbers originally, when I was trying to like figure out where I was at, I knew that I had been working hard for like 5 years at that point. So I think my 6th year of like quote unquote making good money and making over 50 grand a year, over $15,000 a year, really. When I saw those numbers like a year ago, when I was seeing like, oh, I'm top 3% or something of females in the United States, I didn't fight against it. I really wanted to kind of embrace and understand and be truthful with myself about where I am, because if I'm not, then how am I expecting anyone else to be truthful with themselves? And so that was really important for me. Like, again, the person who's listening to this right now, when I asked you, what do you consider yourself? I bet a lot of people said middle or upper middle class and cannot say the word I'm upper class, when in fact you are upper class, and like own it. And like not in a bad way, in a like, cool, you're upper class. It doesn't change anything. But let's just be honest with where we're at.
Did you say you didn't calculate your net worth until last year?
Yeah. I did it one time with my friend Jason when it was like less than 200,000, and I was so proud of it.
Yeah.
And then no, last year was the very first time. Okay. Not only that, I didn't calculate my houses last year. And then only I got this new MacBook. And then I was like, oh, I'm clearly upper class. I've got a MacBook. This is a sign of wealth. But I got this new MacBook like 3 months ago, January. And I actually put in all of my numbers. That was, and literally 3 months ago was the first time I actually calculated my full net worth with housing, like what my houses and equity are in houses. Very first time I ever put that on a spreadsheet.
Interesting.
Again, I'm a fucking filer failure.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So.
And I was surprised.
I'm glad you finally calculated. It's a good thing to take a look at every once in a while. But we started tracking, I think it was like 2014 or so. So we have 10 years of data.
Yeah.
So that's cool to see like how it grew over time. And then once the compound interest really takes over.
Yeah.
But to your point, we actually didn't put in any of our real estate. We just have a single, just the home that we live in.
Yep.
So it's a drop in the bucket, but it's not nothing, right?
Yeah.
'Cause we're like 10 years older than you. So we have a little bit more equity that we built up over time, which even for our single family home here, it's a little bit.
So. And I should say, when I did the CNBC Make It series, I did have to put all my numbers out there. And I think I did calculate at that moment in time. Because when I'm thinking in my head, I'm like, I think I'm lying right now. And so I think that I put it all together at that point because I think I had to put equity in my houses. But like I didn't stick it on a spreadsheet. I just sent it to some lady and, you know, through Gmail and hopefully it was safe.
Gotcha. It's a humble brag there, huh? Oh, just the CNBC.
Make It series.
We'll link up to that. It was on YouTube. And how are the comments on that? People love that shit, don't they?
I don't know. I was told not to read the comments. And so I gave myself 3 minutes. I lasted about 30 seconds. And I decided I didn't give a shit what people said, especially because my situation was unique because like I have a stay-at-home dad because of visa. And people are like, she can do this on her own. She doesn't need this deadbeat or something ridiculous like that. Which like if anyone meets my husband, he's like the most incredible, like holy shit, amazing person in the world. You would want to marry him. Yeah, like amazing. And it was just like, people don't understand your situation. They would, some guy who like was like saying he was a real estate expert was saying how much down payment I put. She put 5% down on all her houses. It literally shows in there. I put 20% down, 15% down. Like it's literally in the video, man. Like, how dumb are you? And so then he's like, these numbers can't be real because, you know, with 5% down, it was just like these speculations, but it's literally in the video. So like, whatever.
Again, that's why I was like,
no, I was like, you can back into my numbers and stuff like that if you want to, because it's like a lot of stuff's just randomly out there, which, you know, again, whatever. But what a funny series.
It's interesting how many people we know that are in those
videos?
Series. Yeah. Like as they popped up, I was like, oh, actually your video, I think, I don't even know if I knew that you did it.
Yeah.
But it popped up as like a next video, like from something else I was watching. And I was like, hey, I know her.
Yeah. Pete didn't even know. We just moved in down the street and then he put it on the blog. He's like, my friends are like so busy getting their house set up that they didn't even mention that they're like on CNBC Make It. So yeah, my humble brag isn't very braggy because I don't actually mention it to anyone. Which I'm proud of it. They did a really great job.
It was a good video. Yeah. So we'll link up to that in case people want to check it out. Leave some positive comments on it.
I won't read it.
Okay. So there were a few others that we'll hit here. I think our conversation is more interesting than the articles and some of the notes here. But we will highlight a couple of them. One, which I think it covers us as individuals and our families. And then like a lot of people in the FIRE community, we're self-made. Like a lot of us did come up from some other class and became millionaires.
Yep.
So again, people are kind of identifying of all the work that they had to put into it and the sacrifice and all that stuff. One of the other big ones, in my opinion, is a lot of the millionaires still have a job.
Mm-hmm.
And again, if you're looking at some of the more higher, the higher cost of living places, like people could be, in air quotes, like scraping by, making 200K a year, and they could have $1 million like townhome.
Correct.
Or something
like that. That's exactly, yeah. Well, scenario three, 100% home, right? That was that was $1 million home.
Yeah.
You have to have a job if you have a $1 million home, because how are you getting money?
Right.
So that, like, because it's not saying, you know, like, you need a job, right? Because your assets, your, that's a primary residence. Your investments aren't giving you that income, right? So you need to get that income somehow. So that makes a lot of sense. I have a job. I have a million, like, I'm net worth $1 million now.
And if you have a job and you have to put up with your boss and like the corporate structure and all that stuff, you're not going to feel as free.
Yeah, and, right.
I think when you think millionaire, we have this idea of like the caricature of the ultra wealthy or whatever. Yeah. But really, it could be just someone who has a job, a normal job, and they just happen to have a lot of equity in their home because they live in a good area that went up in value.
Yeah. Or they've been investing since they were really young, didn't do a lot of stuff. And that's what, you know, that's what they put all their money and time into. So that makes a lot of sense.
So one of the others, and then I'll let you highlight some of your favorites of here, or if you have others, Amberly, but you mentioned it before, and this is, this gets people into trouble across the board, but just comparing yourself to other people or competitors or whatever. Mm-hmm. So there's always someone a little better, a little smarter, younger, stronger, whatever, fill in the blank. Like, you're not going to be as good as you hope. And if you compare yourself to people who are a little bit richer than you and more wealthy, or they have higher income, then you're never going to feel like you've arrived or you're wealthy. And one callback to the income area, there are a lot of surveys, and I don't think it was in this study, but I ran across it. And if you go hunt around, you will find this too. Basically, everyone wants to make about 30 to 50% more.
Right.
It doesn't matter how much they make. They can make a million fucking dollars a year. They want 1.5. Right. Like, just a little bit more would make them feel a little bit comfortable.
Yes.
And it's the scarcity mindset.
Yeah.
And again, it doesn't matter how much you earn.
No.
A little bit more is always just a little bit better.
Yes. Right. It's like, since I've been a kid, it's that whole debate of like, oh, if you have straight hair, you want curly hair. If you have curly hair, you want straight hair. Right. Like, there's a reason why hair straighteners exist and curling irons and all this stuff, right? We want what we can't have, in a sense, or we just want more. And, you know, there's a really great podcast out there that I love, because it's kind of voyeurism to other people's lives. And one thing that that host, Ramit Sethi, says is like, you know, it's how you feel about money is highly uncorrelated to how much money you have. And that's exactly it, that you always want a little bit more. But when you have that little bit more, and when he does his little case studies on his couples, you know, they'll be like, oh, but I did get a $30,000 raise. And he's like, oh, do you feel better now? And they're like, no, I don't. And that's why when I, we talked about, you know, those net worths and things at the very, you know, like middle of this, one of the things I said was it's perception, and it's that scarcity mindset that we just don't have enough, or we're comparing, because all of this is compared to someone else. If I'm looking at net worth, $805,000, I'm upper class. But if I compare myself to a couple of people I know who've got beautiful mountain town, like mountain homes, and their net worth is guaranteed 5 million plus, I am small fish at 800,000. So I can say I'm upper class, and I can be real about that, but I'm on the low end of upper class, right? Like, I'm not like real upper class. So it makes a lot of sense that with that specific thing of like comparing yourself to someone else, It's who are you comparing yourself to? And really, it should be comparing yourself to who you were 5 years ago. Or like for me, like when I'm saying like, oh, I think I lied about actually doing my net worth, because so when I did it just recently, it had changed from that documentary that I did when I kind of just roughly put the numbers together and I stuck something in my head. It's gone up a lot since then, just from market changes and things like that, and acquiring new property. And if I compare myself to myself 2 years ago, holy shit, Amberly, good job. Like, you're doing awesome. If I compare myself to you, who, and Elizabeth, who just retired and she doesn't have to work anymore, like, man, I'm still hustling. Mm-hmm. So comparison is the thief of joy.
I feel like we could end it right there. We still have to keep going. That's a mic drop thing.
Oh, add at the beginning.
So what are some of your other favorites in here? And you can go off of our notes too and pick whatever you want.
I think the biggest thing to think about when you're like, when I'm thinking about this is those three households. Household one, 50-50. Household two, investments. Household three, $1 million home. Again, those people are living very different lives. I mean, maybe not, right? I have no idea. But what you can do with that is very different. So someone like me right now, who has literally $1 million in equity in a couple, like a few properties, but they're income producing assets. They're not my primary residence. So when I'm counting my net worth with that $1 million, that's also producing income. So based on income, I'm also upper class because I can count that income that I'm getting from those properties. And so net worth is a number, but it doesn't really tell the full story unless you know what that number is comprised of. And so again, it makes a lot of sense if someone who has $1 million home thinks they're middle class, even though they are technically not middle class, because they're living a middle class life. Maybe they're paycheck to paycheck. They're a teacher. They're retired on a pension, but they are upper class. They just can't live maybe the way that they perceive, or they literally cannot live the life of somebody who's upper class, who makes a bunch of money and has, you know, net worth of, I don't know, 200, 2 million or something like that, because it's houses and other things. So anyway, so that's something that I think about a lot of, like, what's your actual spending power? Like, what can you do with the money that you've got in regards to either your income or that? And you have some control over it, and you have some control you don't have. So something else I'm thinking about is, we talked about this, I'm always about like behavior and social perception and things like that. Like, the numbers are really cool when it comes to FIRE, but clearly I don't give a shit about them because I didn't actually do my own numbers. But one thing I think about is how things are portrayed. So I love the book that The Millionaire Next Door, because like, are you rich or are you wealthy? And when we're looking at, I was watching this really dumb movie yesterday. I'll think of the name in a second. I don't even know what it is. They like fly to Australia. They had a really bad date. They fly to Australia and they're like going into their sister's wedding, and now they have to fall in love again, I'm sure. I don't know. I got like 30 minutes into it and I was like, can't watch this shit. And I'm looking and it's like, it's these beautiful people wearing beautiful clothes in these beautiful apartments in New York City. Like, how the fuck do you afford this? Then they fly to Australia. One's first class, one's business class. Still, Australian flights are like $1,800, like for a wedding. And then they're staying in this beautiful villa. And I'm looking at all this and I'm like calculating it all in my head. And I'm like, this is what we think normal people are doing, right? Like, this is what upper class or even middle class people are doing, because this is what's perceived in every TV show. They talk about that in Friends, about how, like, how would you have afforded this? Sex in the City, she has a closet full of $60,000 dresses, like all, like everywhere. And so when we're like looking at the world, and we see Instagram and people putting their vacations and highlights. So when we're looking at the world, we're like, oh, but I'm not doing that. So I'm not wealthy. I'm not upper class, because that's what we're assuming upper class is doing. Let me tell you, as an upper class person, I'm working my W-2 job. I am like, I'm literally like calling fridge techs, Samsung, trying to get things under warranty. I am literally calculating utilities for my tenants. I'm calculating Airbnb income. I'm noticing it's going down year after year because Airbnb is saturated and it sucks. And I'm like, oh shit, that's my income going down. Like, uh-oh, what is my net worth going to do? Like, I'm taking care of my child, hanging out with my husband, making food. Like, I'm an upper class person. And I am not flying to amazing destinations in Australia. And so with all that to be said is that we might think something looks a certain way, but it actually doesn't in real life. And because we don't talk about these topics, we don't know. We can't say, like, my friends will literally be like, oh, Amberly, like the way that I work and act, like, are you doing okay? You know, like literally, like, are you doing, like, you don't need, like, do you need to step back? What's going on? And it's like, no, I'm actually, I'm making a lot of money. I have a good net worth. I'm just also still hustling. And that's what an upper class person can look like. Mm-hmm. I'm not living the life of luxury like you, Doug.
Like I said, I'm older than you. So yeah. I had all that energy a decade ago.
Yeah.
Like I had half that energy like a decade ago. So one other one that I'll highlight, and actually you could tell me if I already said this one, because
yeah,
I can't remember.
It's been a while.
a lot of the millionaires are still saving for retirement. So not only are they continuing to work, but they have a dollar amount in mind. They have a net worth in mind. So they're continuing to save. And because of that, like you said, you're working, you're hustling, and it feels different because you are, it feels different than being a millionaire because you're doing the same thing as when you were
making 15 grand a year.
Yeah, exactly.
Literally working the same like amount of hours.
And that, like, even though the financial picture changed and you know it now, and though you accepted it, a lot of people in the survey, 31%, they potentially did not. And they're like, I'm still working hard. Yes. I'm identifying as middle class. Like, that's how I feel. That's how I'm living.
Yep.
So, awesome. Well, it's interesting to talk about, but ultimately, like many, many things, it's an interesting story. It's an interesting discussion.
With nuance.
And I don't have any like grand takeaways. Do you have anything where you're like, oh, or is it just an interesting way to examine how people think about other people, how people think about themselves? We could think about the folks that are the media companies and the journalists that actually like wrote the article, and they're like, oh, this should get some attention. They have their own incentives. And we could think of the people that read the article that are either offended or they agree with it.
Right, yeah.
So, yeah, so you've been nodding. No big takeaway out of this, right?
Well, I really do think that the takeaway is that we probably don't know where we actually stand in the scheme of our standing in this society in regards to class. Class dictated by either income and or net worth. Guarantee people listening to this, probably a lot of them, let us know if you considered yourself, you know, in the actual right category. So I think that's one of my biggest takeaways is more than likely people didn't actually know where they stood, hence why 31% had said middle class, but also it was what percent define themselves as upper middle class, not upper class. Upper class was only 8% considered themselves wealthy when all of them as millionaires were all technically wealthy. So we're looking at 92% did not accurately put themselves in the right box. So I think that's a really fascinating takeaway if we're looking at that. It doesn't tell the whole story. Because again, someone with $1 million net worth and how that's comprised and what you came from, what does that look like? You know, if your family was making $50 million a year and you're only worth $1 million, like you're a failure in your mind, right? Or something. So I find that really a fascinating takeaway. And then, so that you can't, people probably didn't put themselves in the right box from the beginning. And then secondly, our social perceptions of what wealth is in this country and what we are capable of based on the number, like the number of dollars we have, like our own psychological and where we live. So those are my takeaways.
All right. This has been really fun. Thanks for taking time out of your clearly busy schedule. And I know that you launched a new podcast because you were in my podcast accelerator along with Mark and over at Mark's Money Mind, which we could link up to that. But I want to hear about your new show. A couple episodes are out. And just for your reference, I think this episode that we're recording right now is going to come out in like a month or so. So you can sort of frame it that way. But what's your new show? We'll link up to it, but tell us a little about it and what you want to do with it.
Yeah. So right now it's called Jump In Feet First. I'm not 100% sold on that name. So you'll notice that in the podcast, I'm always like, welcome to the podcast, because I don't know exactly what we're doing here. I'm actually really loving the journey right now, but Jump In Feet First really is a podcast talking about life and finances and how to do things just a little bit differently. My strong suit is that I have not followed the quote unquote norm of life. And I think that other people can really benefit from taking a small step outside of their comfort zone to learn or do something new. And that's what I'm covering. So my first episode is really about like digital nomading. My second episode is about finding purpose and how to do that in your life. My third episode is going to be like literally just like a whole finance episode. And so it really does run the gamut in that way.
What's the format of the show?
Yeah, great. It's interview style. So actually, the format of the show really is a conversation around a topic. And so that topic may be digital nomading, as I mentioned, and it's not just me interviewing someone, but us having a conversation around what that means for both of us. And I just choose people who have been doing the thing that I'm interested in. So if you want to be a digital nomad, I found a digital nomad that I really like. And we just talk about what that life is. And then we talk about how in my life I've done that, but not the digital nomading thing, but like the nomad thing, and just what it means specifically. How do you deal with loneliness? How do you deal with routine? How do you deal with that stuff? And the finances behind it. You know, how much does it actually cost to do this? Because a lot of people have ideas of what that looks like, but no one's talking about the real numbers.
Okay. And then how is it different from other shows that are out there?
Yeah, great question. It's me, duh. So yeah, I have two mentors other than our mentorship program, but I have two mentors who are working with me throughout the entire year. And one of the things that they said that they really love is I have a great way of asking questions and getting into information that most people like shy away from, or the guests may not know how to share because they're not being asked the right questions. And what I find is I have a bit of a quirky personality. And so it really comes out in the way that I talk to the people that I'm around. And that transparency is really nice.
You get them to put their guard down and tell a little bit more.
Yeah, exactly. What do you think, Doug? You've listened to it. What do you think that I have different?
I think the way that you can add your own stories without taking over, because there's a difference between like an interview show and a conversation.
Yeah.
And I don't really want to listen to interviews very often.
Yep.
Because it's a little bit artificial. And you, for example, you have a lot of stories to tell.
Yeah.
And there's a great way that you can share your portion of it and relate to even more people, where if it's just a straight interview, it's like question, answer. And this is, you know, sometimes when, you know, big authors, especially, they go on the podcast tour and it's like
same question over and over again. Yeah.
And they have their talking points. Yep. And even some of my favorite authors will have the stalest, I mean, they're thinking about their fucking groceries or something. Like, it's not very interesting. So you'll pull people out of that. And like I said, you'll be able to add your own spin without taking over and have a nice conversation. So I know the ones that I've listened to so far, it's primarily people that you have a pretty good relationship with already. So I'm very interested when you start interviewing people that you don't know and people that maybe you never met in person, and literally like you hop on the call, you're doing the interview, and maybe you've just exchanged a couple of emails before that.
Yep. And actually that was my challenge this week, was to start moving outside my comfort zone in that way. And I have a name in my head of someone I'm going to reach out to see if they're willing to come on and have a chat with me. And I have a topic that I'd love to talk about, because I think that they've been exploring it just like I have over the past year, which really is, you know, stepping away from that scarcity and that, you know, definition of who you were to who you actually are. And that's one of the conversations I want to have. And so I appreciate the compliment of how I'm able to draw people out, because that's exactly what I think my strong suit is, and which is the reason why I wanted to start a podcast. I started with interview style and I thought it was boring as heck. I couldn't do it. I was like, this will last 5 episodes and I'm done. And then I realized a conversation is, I think, my strong suit.
Will you ever do solo episodes?
Yeah, I've thought about that. My biggest factor in not doing it so far is every time I go to record into my computer, I forget to turn it to my mic. And so then I'm just talking to my computer and it sounds absolutely terrible. And I don't want to spend an hour talking to my computer and then turn it out that I did the wrong thing. So yeah, I've actually thought about that. Solo episodes, I think one will be coming up probably around episode number 4, just to explain who I am a little bit. So I think I might go into a short 20-minute episode of just like, what's up, guys? You know, here perfect. I am. Yeah.
Yeah, I think those fit in and people like the variety. So
yeah. And I don't want to be responsible for guests every single time. That's a lot of work to set all that up.
And then, yeah, just prepping for the interview and like making sure you, like if you hit a dead end, like where do you go? Yeah. And I mean, there's a lot of things you could do to try to make it easier. But at the same time, it's like you have to be watching and thinking about the path of the conversation and the story that you're trying to tell. If you are dialing it in that close, but yeah, I think it fits in. Okay, cool. So we'll link up to that so people can get to it. And thanks again, Amberly. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for listening to the show. That was the Mile High Five podcast, and I'm Doug Cunnington, the Balder host, and Carl Jensen is the cool, sexy one. If you dig the show, please do three things for us. Number one, tell a friend, a family member, an enemy about the show. We really don't care who you tell. Maybe forward them a specific show that you know that they will like. It's the single most helpful thing that you can do to spread the word. It's like giving us a virtual high five, and actually we don't give high fives in person, so the virtual kind's pretty good. And more importantly, your friend or family member or even your enemy will appreciate the fact that you were thinking of them. Number two, make sure you're following or subscribed on your podcast app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Overcast, YouTube, whatever you're using, and that way you won't miss a show. And number three, please leave us a rating and review. We read them on the show occasionally, and you might hear yours out there on an upcoming episode. Quick disclaimer, this show is not financial or legal advice. I'd actually be surprised if it sounded like it. It's really just for entertainment, and that's at least what we're hoping for. But seriously, get advice from professionals. Carl and I are just two guys with microphones that sit in my basement and talk. So we'll catch y'all next week. What's been going on with you? I haven't seen you in a couple weeks here. So what's new?
I don't know. Goodness gracious, what is new? I feel like everything is new and nothing is new at the same time. You know when you just like feel like you're really busy and you're getting a lot of tasks done, but it's just like scratching off things on your to-do list? So, okay, like, hey, Doug, I did all the utilities for my tenants a week ago, and then tomorrow I have to do all the Airbnb income to pay out my tenants for owning an Airbnb. Got a fridge partially fixed for the fourth time. We'll see on Monday. Maybe the fifth time is the charm. Tired as F because it turns out, you know, when you have a baby growing, I'm 3 months out from producing this baby into the world. Like, you don't have lung capacity anymore. So you'll probably actually hear that today. Like, as I catch my breath from talking. So yeah, like everything and nothing.
It sounds pretty busy, and a lot of maybe I'll call it just not fun stuff, where it's just like, you have to run those numbers.
Yeah, it's a daily grind.
You have to do those stuff or those things. You have to like get the fucking fridge fixed or whatever.
Yes, and you have to call like seven people to do it. Then you have to fight with them because like who's paying for the fix? Yeah, that's been a whole thing. Don't buy Samsung or LG.
Okay.
Yeah. Don't ever sponsor this podcast.
Yeah. I was going to say they were going to send a check. They were going to sponsor the show because we have a Samsung fridge. Knock on wood, it's been fine so far.
Dusty's just broke.
Oh, really?
I don't think hers is 5 years old either.
No.
We're coming up on,
it's four and some change. So I think that's the point where they die.
So if you're under that 5 year mark from the time it was purchased or manufacturer's warranty, which is in the door of the thing, and you have any issues with it, call them right away and like get that ticket started.
All right.
Yeah.
I hope it's okay.
It will be.
It should be fine.
If not, yeah.
Well, with us, we went on a trip to see some national parks. So that was all good. And I caught a cold on the way back, and you were in the podcast accelerator, which we talked about earlier in the show, which we're recording this ahead of time. So our timelines are all kind of crazy here, but you were in the podcast accelerator. So you experienced chatting with me and seeing me get sick over like not vomiting, but just physically sick and not quite losing my voice, but just struggling.
Yeah.
And I've heard other people, actually a couple of podcasts that I listened to, one guy's like, I've got laryngitis and it's still sticking around. And occasionally, I think it's like when I drink water or something cold, a lot of times it sort of tickles my throat or something.
Yeah.
So.
And you got sick for like 2 different weeks.
Yeah.
Like before and after.
Yeah, yeah. And it was like I felt pretty good most of the time and I had to actually force myself to rest and sit around because it's really, I'm like, oh, I'll just do these couple little things. Yeah. But if I would overexert myself, or I mean, I wouldn't feel like I was overexerting myself. I'm just like fucking answering emails or something. But anyway, I forced myself to sit around, which was fine.
Good.
It's opposite good for you. Of you. Yeah.
It's good for you.